Jaya Radha Madhava. वेदांत गोस्वामी श्री प्रभुपाद की जय। श्रीपाद परमहंस परिभाषिकाचार्य स्तोत्र सर श्री श्रीमद दिवाइन ग्रे शिव भक्ति सिद्धांत सरस्वती ठाकुर महाराज शिव प्रभुपाद की जय। अनंत कोटि वैष्णव वृंद की जय। आचार्य शिव प्रभुपाद की जय। नामाचार्य श्री हरिदास ठाकुर की जय। प्रेम से गौ श्री कृष्ण चैतन्य प्रभु नित्यानंद श्री अद्वैत गदाधर श्रीवासारी गौर भक्तवृंद की जय। श्री राधा कृष्ण गौर गोपीनाथ श्याम कुंड राधे कुंड गिरी गोविंदान की जय। श्री श्री वृंदावन धाम की जय। श्री श्रीनवृत धाम की जय। श्री मायपुर धाम की जय। श्री श्री मथुर धाम की जय। श्री श्री वृंदावन धाम की जय। श्री श्री गोविंदान धाम की जय। श्याम वेद भक्तवृंद की जय। ऑल ग्लोरीज टू समूल ग्लोरीज ऑल ग्लोरीज टू समूल ग्लोरीज ऑल ग्लोरीज टू समूल ग्लोरीज ऑल ग्लोरीज टू श्री श्री गुरु श्री गौरांग नारायणं नमस्कृत्यं नरं चैव नरोत्तमं देवीं सरस्वतीं व्यासं तथो जयमुदीराय नास्तादेशु अपादेशं भगवत सेवाय भगवती धामश्लोके भक्तिभवजीनाष्टिके। रीडिंग फ्रॉम श्रीमद् भागवतम सिक्स्थ चैप्टर और सिक्स्थ कैंटो सिक्स्थ चैप्टर 37th वर्स राइट 37th वर्स
Chitti Adivesha Kalavrita Saptabir Dasha Gunatarair Andakoshaha Yatra Patyanta Anu Kalpa Sahanda Koti Koti Bistarananthaha Chitti Adivesha Kalavrita Saptabir Dasha Gunatarair Andakoshaha Yatra patyan patatanyu kalpaha Sahanda koti koti vistaranantaha Sitya viresha kilavrita Sapta virdasha gunotarai randakoshaha Yatra patyanu kalpa
Yatra patyanu kalpa
Sahanda koti koti vistarantaha
Sahanda koti koti vistarantaha Sityadi viresha kilavitaha
Sityadi viresha kilavita
Satavirdasa gunottarair amdakoshaha
Sathavirdasa gunatarai randakoshaha
Yatra patatyanu kalpa
Yatra patyananu kalpa
Sahanda koti koti vistar anantaha
Sahanda koti koti vistar anantaha
Shiti adibir esha kilavrita
Shiti adibir esha kilavrita
Sathavir dasha gunatarai randakoshaha
Yatra patyat anu kalpa
Sahanda koti koti vistar Ananta
Sahanda koti koti vistar Anantaha Anyone else? Ladies? It's strange Sanskrit configuration. Word for word. Chiti adhibihi. In the ingredients of the material world. Headed by earth. Eshaha. This. Kila. Indeed. Avritaha. Covered. Saptabhi. Seven. Dashaguna aturai. Each 10 times more than the previous one. Andakoshaha. Egg-shaped. Egg-shaped universe. Yatra. And whom? Patati. Falls. Anukapaha. Like a minute atom. Saha with Andakoti Koti Bihi Billions of such universes.
Millions of such universes.
Tat therefore.
Ananta. You are called unlimited.
You are called unlimited.
Translation by Srila Prabhupada. Every universe is covered by seven layers: earth, water, fire, air, sky, the total energy, and false ego, each 10 times greater than the previous one. There are innumerable universes besides this one, and although they are unlimitedly large, they move about like atoms in you. Therefore, you are called unlimited, Ananta. Purport by Srila Prabhupada. In the Brahma Samhita 5.48, the Brahma Samhita 5.48 says, Yasyaika nishvasita kalam tablalambya jivanti loma vilaja jagarandanata vishnur mahansa eva yasya kale vishesho govindamari purusham tamaham vajami. The origin of the material world is Mahavishnu, who lies in the causal ocean. While he sleeps in that ocean, millions of universes are generated as he exhales, and they are all annihilated when he inhales. This Mahavishnu is a plenary portion of Vishnu, Govinda, Yasya Kala Visheshaha. The word Kala refers to a plenary portion of a plenary portion. From Krishna or Govinda comes Balaram. From Balaram comes Sankarshan. From Sankarshan, Narayan. From Narayan, the second Sankarshan. From the second Sankarshan, Mahavishnu, the Mahavishnu, Garbhadakshaya Vishnu. And from Garbhadakshaya Vishnu, Kshirodakshaya Vishnu. Kshirodakshaya Vishnu controls every universe. This gives an idea of the meaning of Ananta, unlimited. What is to be said of the unlimited potency and existence of the Lord? This verse describes the coverings of the universe. Saptavir Dasha Gunotarayar Gunotarayar Andakosha, the coverings of the universe. The first covering is earth, the second is water, the third is fire, the fourth is air, the fifth is sky, the sixth is the total material energy, and the seventh is the false ego. Beginning with the covering of earth, each covering is 10 times greater than the previous one. Thus, we can only imagine how great each universe is, and there are millions of universes. As confirmed by the Lord Himself in Bhagavad Gita 10.42, Atava Bahunaitena Kim Gyatena Tavarjana Pistabhayam Itam Kritsnam Ekam Shena Stito Jagat. But what need is there, Arjuna, for all this detailed knowledge? With a single fragment of myself, I pervade and support the entire universe. The entire material world manifests only 1/4 of the Supreme Lord's energy. Therefore, he is called Ananta. Translation again by Srila Prabhupada. Every universe is covered by 7 layers: earth, water, fire, air, sky, the total energy, and false ego, each 10 times greater than the previous one. There are innumerable universes besides this one, and although they are unlimitedly large, they move about like atoms in you. Therefore, you are called unlimited, Ananta. Bhukam karuti vachalam pangamam gayate jikirin yakripatar hammadeshi garudina tadane. Prabhupada is emphasizing in the purport that the Lord is infinite, but he's also very small or infinitesimal. There are some examples of infinite and infinitesimal. One is that the Kshirodakshaya Vishnu, or the all-pervasive aspect of the Lord, is in every atom and very small in the Anu portions. Sometimes the dimensions of the solar are enumerated. And one of the ways that it's enumerated is that it's a very small portion of the tip of a hair. The tip sounds like a very imprecise thing, and these days we're accustomed to quantifying and measuring everything exactly. Like we talk about things in terms of centimeters and kilos and things like that. But in Vedic literature, sometimes we encounter words like the tip of a hair. And in the English language, sometimes there's words that aren't very precisely measurable, like grains and granules, tips, bits,
pieces, parts, but they're very commonly used. So in one sense, everything is not correct. What we learn and study about the structure of the universe and the structure of material things and atoms is difficult. It's very precise, and it sometimes involves, there's a lot of advancement in terms of transportation, in terms of communication, medicine, travel. And so being able to measure has its benefits, but in another sense, it's not beneficial. Like in most books, we will read that a thing is the size of a hand rather than being, say, 10 by 15 centimeters, the size of a human hand, or the size of a box, or a bread box, or something like that. So there's a lot of scope for using words that aren't very precise, and we don't know what exactly a mustard seed is in dimensions, but it's a very small thing. And the same with a grain of sand, it's a very small thing, but they're not necessarily measured, and they're not all necessarily the same. But Prabhupada, because he came to the Western world where things are always, not always, but usually measurable, at least in science, they're measurable and quantifiable. He talked about, there's references in the Vedic literatures about the dimension of the soul. The soul is very fine, and it's supposed to be very, very insignificantly, almost invisible, even by the most powerful microscope, so one cannot see what the soul is. And yet, the dimensions of the soul are mentioned in the different parts of Vedic literature as Keshagra, Esham. In the Bhagavad Gita, I think in the 10th chapter, the last verse says that Prabhupada quotes it here, the 10th chapter, 42nd verse, Atava Ekam Shenas Tato Jagat is the last verse. And that means that there's, Ekam Shena means one part of the whole universe. So Krishna is saying that even though he's very, very large, he controls all the universes, and there's more than one universe according to this purport. There's several universes, many universes, millions of universes actually. And we tend to think that we're the only universe, but according to this Bhagavad Gita verse and other parts of Vedic literature, this part of the material world is only a small 1/4 of the whole creation. It's mentioned as Ekam Shenas Tato Jagat, one part. But that one part is mentioned in the Puranas and in the Chaitanya Charitamrita verse. There's a verse that says what that part is, and it's only 1/4 part. In other words, we're in a in the 1/4 part, and the 3/4 of creation are the spiritual world, and 1/4 is the material world. So in a sense, we're kind of in a minority part of the world. And what we think is very gigantic and very huge is actually a very small and very very minute portion. And the translation that Prabhupada gives here is, but what need is there, Arjuna, for all this detailed knowledge? With a single fragment of myself, I pervade this entire universe. The entire material world manifests only 1/4 of the Supreme Lord's energy. Therefore, he is called Ananta. So here he translates it that it is 1/4, even though it's not in the Bhagavad Gita. And one of the Bhagavad Gitas, I think in all the Bhagavad Gitas, it just says one part. It doesn't say 1/4. But here, it is 1/4. And it's mentioned also in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, which is a Padma Purana quote, that it is only 1/4. So what we think is the entire universe, the whole thing, is only 1/4 of the whole creation. So in a sense, we're a very small part of the whole creation. And not only an insignificant part of it, but a part that is relatively small and not the normal condition. We have a feeling that this is the normal condition that we live in. But it's not really normal. It's a difficult thing. We tend to think that everything is perfect and enjoyable here in the material world, and everything is based on enjoyment. But actually, there's another kind of enjoyment which is spiritual, and in lectures, Prabhupada has talked about Krishna consciousness being a process of recreation. There's just singing and dancing and feasting. And actually, what is more enjoyable than singing and dancing and feasting? Is there anything very difficult about singing and dancing and feasting? That's what people like to do, sing and dance and feast. And when films first started coming out, I don't know what it was like, but there was a lot of what we used to call them musicals. There was a lot of singing and dancing. Still, there's a lot of singing and dancing in films that are made in certain parts of the world. There's a lot of, it's required that there's always singing and dancing. So in one sense, the process of Krishna consciousness, although it's very philosophically deep and very, very precise in terms of philosophy and very exacting, and sometimes in Navadvip people were considered to be great celebrities if they were successful in debates. But this is a process basically of enjoyment, of celebration, of singing and dancing and feasting. And this is what everyone likes to do. But but it can be done in a spiritual way, and that's what temples are for. That's what is the process in temples of singing and dancing. That's what people do. They eat, and from what I'm told, there's more Hare Krishna restaurants in this country than any other country per capita. So singing and dancing, it's a recreational process. This is going on always in the three-quarters part of the creation of the spiritual world, singing, dancing, and feasting. But it's being done in a spiritual way. It's being done for Krishna. Whereas what we live in now is very contaminated. We've never seen pictures of Krishna meditating, Krishna operating machinery, or Krishna in any way reading newspapers. Never see pictures of Krishna doing that. Krishna is always enjoying. He's playing the flute, he's dancing, he's singing, he's eating, but never operating machinery. Never. And in this world in which we live, things are based on technology. The word science used to mean knowledge, general knowledge, but now it's come to mean technology or things like that. When I was at university, there was a growing department that was the technology department. It was known as a liberal arts university, but that was also literature and history, but it was being overtaken by the so-called science wing. The science wing were basically people that were learning about technology and things like that. And very measuring things and medical things and measurements. The first time I think I ever saw Prabhupada become angry was when someone that he was lecturing at the University of California at Berkeley, and someone in the audience was unseen because it was in a very dark, darkened room, was saying, "What is the purpose of all this spiritual knowledge that you're propagating, when I've come to study technology, and that's the most important thing. That's what's going to alleviate poverty in my country." This person, he was probably from India, and he said, "I'm learning technology, and that is the most important thing." And this is the first time I ever saw Prabhupada become very angry, and he recognized that this person was from his country, and he was very angry because this person had come to the West to study technology, and he called him a beggar, and that he said, "I am a giver. I'm giving spiritual knowledge, and you've come to learn technical knowledge. You've come to this university not to study history or language or anything else but mathematics and physics and chemistry so that you can really alleviate poverty, supposedly. And I've come to give spiritual knowledge." So something very unusual was started in the United States. It was the beginning of a movement of spiritual knowledge and a sense to bring God back into society. We live in a fairly godless world. I was one time giving a talk in Boston. Boston is the city in the United States which is the home of Massachusetts Institute of Technology, which is considered to be one of the leading universities for technology. But because people are very inimical to the very concept of God, that there's a supreme controller over the universe, I didn't use the word God, I said the G word, because I knew that these people were very inimical toward the concept that there could be a controller. Actually, it is a very commonplace thing that people are very very disturbed when there's the idea of someone who is in control of everything. Actually, we learn in school that we have to be in control. We have to question authority, and we have to be the ultimate authorities and the ultimate people who decide what is right and what is wrong. Actually, the Bhagavad Gita, this is the Srimad Bhagavatam, but the Bhagavad Gita, or the Song of God, which is the main treatise of Krishna consciousness, establishes what is right and what is wrong. It is the basic idea of what is right and what is wrong. And in the dust jacket of the Bhagavad Gita, there's three people are quoted. One is Emerson, one is Thoreau, and one is Gandhi. And Mahatma Gandhi was saying that when doubts assail me, when I become bewildered, I pick up the Bhagavad Gita and I read a verse and it pacifies me. I become very, very pacific and very satisfied that my wants are insignificant and that my agitation, bewilderment is insignificant. And Emerson wrote that he's quoted there in the dust jacket, that I owed a great day to the Bhagavad Gita. But Thoreau's quote was that Bhagavad Gita is very magnificent. And from that quote, one can guess that he was reading Bhagavad Gita not just once, but every day. And he said, his quote starts that, in the morning I bathe my intellect in the phenomenal and cosmogonal philosophy of Bhagavad Gita. And in the morning kind of indicates, and it can be interpreted, that he was reading it more than once, in maybe every morning. And if he lived to be about 50 years old and he started reading it when he was 20, he might have read Bhagavad Gita thousands of times. And so I just want to ask how many people here are reading Bhagavad Gita even once or twice or thrice or four times or five times or six times. But people find this philosophy is very significant. It's the ultimate treatise about right and wrong and what one should do with one's life. If a person becomes subjected to living in this material world, this one-fourth of the creation, there's a very difficult passage into the spiritual world. Even though Krishna consciousness is very, very easy, it's a system of recreation, singing, dancing, and feasting. It's also required that one follow certain regulated principles, that one has to be a little bit austere. So there's the notion that a yogi is someone who lives in a cave or in Himalayas and is renounced and doesn't associate with people and is very aloof from society. But a Krishna conscious yogi is a person who lives in cities and in very, very heavily populated areas. And those persons' mountains or caves are like the streets and cars and byways and universities where there are thousands of people, not just a few people. So it's a kind of renunciation. The Rupa Goswami writes about that renunciation that renounces the world and says the world is bad and I'm not going to associate with anything in the world. It's only partial. And true renunciation is Vairagya, he says, is not something it's true renunciation is something that we do in life. We participate in, and in many ways Krishna conscious people are acting and they seem to be doing many things. They're involved with technology, but they're doing it for Krishna, and that kind of renunciation is considered to be the perfect renunciation instead of just giving up and going away. That kind of yoga is considered to be imperfect. There's a river in India which is underground, and it's considered to be an important river, but it runs underground. It's sort of like an underground aquifer. So it's called Falgu, and that means it's hidden or unknown. And so renunciation can be also unknown by people who engage in activity that doesn't seem to be necessarily giving up or going away or renouncing or living in a cave or in the Himalayas. There's another kind of renunciation that involves activity. There was a conference, an ecological conference in Brazil about 20 years ago, and people that were invited were involved in ecology, and they were quite amazed to know that people that were in the Krishna consciousness movement involved themselves in technology. They drove cars, they used computers, they printed their books in very high technological ways. And the idea was that these people were all invited to learn that technology could be a very useful thing. it's engaged in the right way. So that's the principle of renunciation in Krishna consciousness. So I think I'll end here if there's any comments or questions anyone wants to make. I'll do my best. Yes? Well, my understanding of this phenomenon is that there's a risk in everything we do. And at one time, devotees started playing a lot of electric guitars and using those kinds of instruments that are used by rock groups. And they were more interested in the beat, in the music, in the rock music, than in Krishna. And so at this time, Prabhupada asked that the devotees simplify things, and they use only simple things like harmonium and kartals. So there is a limit. There is a risk in everything we do. One, even in book distribution, a woman can fall in love with a beautiful man, and vice versa, a man can fall in love with a beautiful woman, even while doing frontline preaching activity. So there's a risk always involved in whatever we do. But in the name of Yukta Vairagi is the end of the verse by Rupa Goswami that says that we can use the renunciation. That means giving up everything and not doing anything is incomplete. And sometimes in the name of Yukta Vairagya, people go too far, you might say. And things have to be simplified when that happens. Yes?
The coverings of the universe, are they inhabited?
Nothing in Prabhupada's books that says the coverings of the universe are inhabited. So I'm not aware of that. Anything else? One thing I wanted to mention is that the coverings are so thick and the Krishna planet is so far away that it's said in the Shastras that one can travel at great speed and still not reach that. And a great speed means that it's not just kilometers per hour, the speed of light, it's called the speed of mind. The speed of mind is so rapid that we can think of some place in Germany and we can be there instantaneously. But according to the Shastras, what we can travel at that speed for millions of years and still not reach the spiritual planet of Krishna. It's so far away. But at the same time, by chanting Krishna's name, and by chanting and dancing and feasting, one can attain that planet instantaneously. Yes?
You said, for instance, if I'm on Harinam, I'll be in the temple and I'm chanting kartals and chanting Hare Krishna, but the kartals are out of time. Should I not play the kartals?
Say that again?
If I'm playing kartals and chanting Hare Krishna, I can't keep in time perfectly. Should I not play the kartals?
Well, naturally, it's nice to keep time, if that's what you mean by not being able to play kartals, not being able to keep time. But at the same time, the ecstasy, ecstatic chanting can be controlled. There was an instance, there was a gentleman who used to every Sunday, Bhaktivedanta Manor in England, he used to bring one person, and that person became a member. We call the life member, and he paid a certain amount. But unbeknownst to many of the devotees, this man was harboring something he didn't really like about the way that the devotees were chanting. They were chanting sometimes wildly, sometimes showing the soles of their feet to the deities and dancing and playing out of tune and out of beat. So when Prabhupada came to Bhaktivedanta Manor, this person decided to vent his grievances to Prabhupada. And he didn't come into the room, he just stood in the doorway. And it was the first time that the devotees had ever seen this man evidence any kind of hesitation. And he said, "We people, we don't like the way these people are dancing." And I said, we people like it when they're just sit-down kirtan and they play very mellow kirtan. Those weren't the words he used, but that was the idea. They play with tablas and harmonium and And Prabhupada looked at him for about 10 seconds and just shook his head and said, you cannot control ecstasy. So whether we're playing in tune or out of tune or in beat or out of beat, it really, in a sense, it doesn't matter. It's nice that when things are nice musically, but they can't always be. But it's nice when they are. And Krishna really likes beautiful things. And every mantra, every verse in Bhagavad Gita and in Srimad Bhagavatam all throughout the Vedic literature is poetic. There's one verse that says, yad yad bi padam natesham, yad pat padam padam yad bi padam natesham, which means there's danger in every step. It's a very poetic saying, yad yad padam padam yad bi padam natesham. Padam means step, and it means that there's danger in every step. So every one of these verses is a piece of poetry. So something that is very beautiful artistically is very much appreciated, but it's not always possible to attain that level. But if a person has love of Krishna in their heart, his or her heart, that's the main thing. And it really doesn't matter whether playing is perfect or not perfect. Of course, if you're playing and it's disturbing others, then probably it's best not to do it. But ecstasy, like Prabhupada said, can't be controlled.
Yes. Sorry, why does some Krishna depicted with blue skin and other people with blue skin? Or is it just a religious thing?
Why is he? Well, he's not just depicted as blue, he is blue. Yeah, I mean, we have different colors of our skin, but we don't. And here on the cover of this book, these are the Vishnu Dutas, and they're bluish color. And once someone asked Prabhupada, why is the sky blue? And there's a kind of effulgence that emanates from the body of Krishna, and that's called the Brahma Jyoti, and that's why the sky itself is blue, because it's a bluish hue or a bluish tint. It's a very unusual color, for a skin color, and we don't see any beings on this planet with blue skin. Brown skin, white skin, black skin, but blue is unusual. That's the color of Krishna. Of course, sometimes Krishna in the deity form is depicted as black. Actually, his color is described in the Brahma Samhita and other places as the color of a fresh rain cloud. It's sort of a bluish black. And sometimes Krishna has a white color, and he appears in different ages in different colors. But his original color, he is blue. And we see a lot of pictures of Krishna, and he's always colored blue, because he is blue. There was a devotee who dressed up, a young devotee, about a five-year-old girl, who dressed up like Krishna and painted herself all blue. And at the time, it was called the Year of the Child in England. And the then Prime Minister, Margaret Thatcher, thought this child was very cute and walked up to her and embraced her, even though she had a lot of bodyguards around her. She said, why are you blue? And the little child said, because Krishna is blue. Thought that was pretty interesting. Anything else? Doesn't have to be about this verse, but just anything at all. Okay, I think we'll end there. Hare Krishna.